Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name's Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in the Private Eye office, joined as ever by Ian Hislop, Adam McQueen and Helen Lewis. We're here to talk about the events of the last week's and who knows, maybe the next week's too. And one event that, Helen, you've been looking into recently is a change in the laws in Scotland. And I won't say any more than that.
Okay. Well, this is obviously blown up on the 1st of April when the law came into force, but it was actually passed in 2021. It's called the Hate Crime and Public Order Bill. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the aim of it was to consolidate all existing hate crime legislation into one easy-to-swallow package, as it were. But the controversial thing that it did, which was extremely controversial even as it went through the Scottish Parliament, was introduce this new offence of stirring up hatred. Now, even then, it got watered down. The original proposal was that libraries and bookshops would have been able to be prosecuted for selling offensive or loaning offence material. So things like that got watered down. But all the way through, there were concerns that this was a very illiberal law. And sure enough, now it's finally come into force. Those concerns have come up again.
What is stirring up?
Well, it's basically trying to say that if you... So there was a lot of discussion about whether or not intention mattered. Did you need to intend to be offensive on this? And does it need to have an objective effect? Or in hate crimes law, there's always the question about, is it just as experienced by the person? And as I can see, your eyes are already slightly misting, and you're getting the point that this stuff is really difficult.
It's hard.
It's effectively based on personal conceptions of what is offensiveness, right? In the same way that, I'm sure you know this, Ian, like libel, there's always, you know, it's the idea of a kind of reasonable person. There are obviously a very large spectrum of beliefs about what constitutes hateful behaviour or is merely abusive behaviour. And so it has to, in some respect, you have to say, well, who gets to decide what's hateful? And that's part of what's at issue here.
The problem, as I see it, seems to be that they've said that, well, Police Scotland get to decide, because usually legislators don't say this, but they're essentially saying, yes, you're right, this is a very badly drawn up law and it's very imprecise and who knows what it means. Let's ask the police. Now, for those of us who've been rather more sceptical about the entire Scottish establishment over the years than, say, the SNP, it might be argued that Police Scotland have been a touch too close to those in power over the years, and their definition may just be whatever pleases the party in power. I'm not going to be so cheap as to say, why don't they look into real crimes, like who nicked that camper van, and, because that would be pathetic. No,
that would be beneath you. But you're right, there is a problem. A couple of months ago, Police Scotland said, we're not going to be able to investigate all low-level crime, including some things like theft. But they have pledged they will investigate every single thing that's reported under this law.
I'm sorry to be really thick about it. Uh-huh. What am I going to be banged up for in Stirling,
right,
that I won't be in Sunderland?
Unless you can make a flit across the border. So they've added age, disability, transgender status, intersex status and religion. Now, there were already provisions on race and ethnicity for stirring up hatred on those grounds. So that was already covered. However, what you'll notice, the one characteristic missing from that list is sex. So that's supposedly because there is going to be a separate misogyny bill coming down the track. However, Ash Reagan, who was in the Scottish Government as a junior justice minister, has now defected to ALBA, said, I actually feel like I was misled on that. I was told that all the women's groups didn't want misogyny. They wanted a separate bill. And I don't actually now think that was true. My hunch and suspicion is that misogyny is a very difficult thing to prosecute. It's also not in the Equality Act. Because, you know, is calling someone a bitch misogynistic abuse? Well, yes, it is, but it is also extremely common. And there is a kind of point at which the police cannot be expected to get involved in absolutely everything.
Someone actually said, I mean, read the bill, they said, the reason we didn't include women in the bill, the sex in the bill, is because we didn't feel the bill would really work very well for them. And we're going to do a better one later. Well, if you're going to do a better one later, could you do a better one for all the other
categories? Again, these
categories
all seem like quite a lot of arguments that this is not the bill to put through at the moment, isn't it?
It is. And what the political thing I don't understand is, why does Humza Yousaf, who's not having a great time as leader, why did he go ahead with this?
Well, it's really interesting. It wasn't in the 2016 Holyrood Manifesto from the SNP. It was something that they kind of came off with on their own bat. And it was a time when they were, I think, slightly on the back foot because of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. They'd spent a whole lot of time saying, we're much further to the left than Labour, you know, we're the true voice of what a progressivism is. Then the Corbyn era slightly challenged them on that. So they pivoted to saying, we're actually much more competent. And so I think they were in their post, you know, Corbyn era of opposing Labour in Scotland, they were trying to look for a new identity again. And I think they looked at this as something that was very distinctive and could be very SNP focused. The same thing with the gender recognition reform bill. This was a progressive country and they were a progressive party. And therefore, this was the kind of legislation they wanted to pass. The problem being, I think, the Scottish civil society is very small. And lots of the groups and charities they were asking for input on this were people who received grants from the SNP. You know, and they have been in power now in Scotland for more than a decade. Not very seriously challenged by either Labour or the Conservatives, who are both in the minority at Holyrood. So I think what it was a sort of initially interesting idea, but that just did not receive sufficient scrutiny throughout the legislative process. And once it's passed, it's passed. It comes in.
One of the things I found most fascinating about this is replacing the blasphemy law. You know, however many hundred years we are now after the Scottish Enlightenment. I found it extraordinary the blasphemy law was still on the statute book. But religious discrimination or stirring up hatred on grounds of religion is one of the measures in this bill that's perhaps had slightly less scrutiny. But I was thinking back to when something similar was introduced in Britain. Do you remember the Racial and Religious Hatred Act, which finally came in 2007? That was on the third go. It was stymied by the Lords a couple of times. It was stymied by Rowan Atkinson, do you remember, leading a campaign, popping up saying, But I do vicars. That's one of the comedy things I do. I may be slightly simplifying his argument there, I think.
And it's perfectly reasonable. There's an incredibly long tradition of laughing at vicars in British humour. And it's many hundreds of years old, and this was taken as one of our rights. Whether one is allowed to laugh at imams is another thing. And Rowan Atkinson, and he didn't have an equivalent. But in Scotland, that will be an issue.
And that's something that you have to, in all hate crimes legislation tries to do, is what's the difference between an ideology and a person? And sometimes that's very clear cut and sometimes it's not. So the one that has obviously become a very high profile is the fact that J.K. Rowling has basically dared people. She's called a load of trans women men, essentially, and used male pronouns for them, and said, you know, come and lock me up. And that is the debate that is now going to be forced into the open about, is that actually hateful to people as individuals, or are you opposing a particular ways of thinking about gender?
Well, I think it goes back to stirring up, doesn't it? If I'm insulting someone in their home based on these newly protected characteristics, I mean, let's say age, for example, because that's one of these five new ones, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you say call someone a silly old sod as you shove them out of the way on the, you know, and is that becoming aggravating? Is that worth the police's time to add that as an aggravating factor?
But from a personal and professional point of view, I mean, there's some debate about whether satire and comedy comes under this bill. So most of the jokes about Biden that have been in the publication recently haven't been policy-based. A number of them, I would say, have been directed to the fact that he's very, very old.
Are you saying we're going to have to smuggle copies of the magazine over the border? I think this is quite romantic and Bonnie Prince Charlie-ish, and I like the sound of it.
Sam is that copies of the Eye going, he's very old, you know, he sometimes speaks quite slowly.
It's the Walter Scott novel.
They'll be cutting sections out of the joke pages at the border, won't they? Be like Fahrenheit 451, people will be memorising jokes and telling them quietly in pubs in Edinburgh.
But that does make sense, because there are people who don't want you to make jokes about Biden's age. I wrote a piece about his age and people said this is very offensive, it doesn't say anything about his cognitive capacity, you shouldn't, this isn't, you know, you're attacking someone's personal life. And that's, you know, that is an argument that people do make.
And again, they didn't make it clear. So one spokesman says, obviously, this doesn't apply to comedians and satirists and performers. And then another person says, well, it might. And it seems to be up to the police again. So say your one-hour act at Edinburgh is entirely devoted to the failings of the Police Scotland. Is that stirring up hatred?
It's such a vague term, isn't it? So it seems a very unlegalese term to me, stirring up, that it can be. I mean, if you're drawing attention to someone else's stuff online about this stuff, or writing a story about a neo-Nazi group that then ends up, you know, in a backlash, lots more people join that. I mean, would that count as stirring up?
So I think the language is abusive or threatening or insulting. And I the word, use of the word insulting is slightly alarming to me, because I quite enjoy insulting a number of people on all kinds of grounds. But the defence is about being, you have to prove that it's reasonable. And it's one of those things where it's just, well, what my version of reasonable, your version of reasonable may be entirely different. Who's the arbiter here?
It does seem to me that J.K. Rowling she seems to be absolutely determined to become a martyr, a free speech martyr on this particular topic. But she was going, I mean, there's very much an intent now. I mean, because you said she misgendered several trans people. But actually, I mean, what she did was list a load of convicted sex offenders, chuck in Monroe Bergdorf, who is someone she has a problem model, with, yeah. and India Willoughby, who's a former newsreader, right? Yeah, but it was very deliberately done as a provocation, wasn't it? So, I mean, that in that case, intent was very definitely there.
Yeah.
Or it maybe didn't even need to be.
Well, I think the interesting thing is the question about whether or not, has she created a shield about this law ever being used, right? In the sense that people could go, well, hang on, why are you coming after me and not J.K. Rowling? Or, I just thought about the equivalence with abortion laws, which, I think when you cover them in Northern Ireland, for example, they would go after people who were kind of slightly defenceless and say, just plead guilty and we can make this go away. And I think that's my slight worry about it, is if you have somebody who, say, mentally ill, does some very bad tweets, but they're not in a position to defend themselves, really, what are the, are they just going to go after people like that? And actually, is that a good use of police time? Are those people really going to learn anything from the experience, or is it just going to compound an existing problem? That's my question about it.
And are we now waiting to see exactly that? What does happen next and how it's used?
There are people who think it's overblown. So Adam Tomkins, who has a voice I respect, he was a Conservative MSP and a law professor, said, actually, now that we put in some of the more safeguards in it, some of the provisions have been watered down, I'm not so worried about it. So I think there is a case where it doesn't actually necessarily lead to anything. I'm just, in principle, opposed to laws on statute books that the police can use against political opponents of the regime, right? If this was happening somewhere else, that's how you would describe it.
Yeah, and there seem to be two things that worry. One is specifically, because it happens all the time, the eyes, is this idea of third-party reporting. If someone else says, I was really offended by this piece on your behalf, and then reports you, as people often do to regulatory bosses, is that okay? Usually you're saying, well, shouldn't the person doing the reporting be the person who was supposedly harmed by it? And that strikes me as, given lobby groups and groups of people who band together to do third-party reporting in occasions which are not always justifiable, that strikes me as a problem. The other is this, it is pure Orwell now. We've now got, if the police decide this hate incident isn't criminal, it's a non-crime hate incident. And it's logged. Mm. So the fact that someone said you were up to no good, the police say it's not a crime, but it is a hate incident. So what does that mean?
It's very like the old Scottish verdict of not proven, isn't it? Which means not guilty, but don't do it again. Yeah. That's kind of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
The non-crime hate incidents are, I think, really troublesome. I'm not quite sure how they kind of just sort of, I don't remember there being a big backlash to them when they were brought in. But every time I've heard about one of them, essentially, if you get someone complains against you, you don't often even get notified of it. So you didn't get a chance to go, well, that person's mad, or we've had an argument over our Leylandii, and then that's what, all the things you'd expect of kind of due process.
Yeah.
So there's an incident in Scotland, Murdo Fraser, who's a Conservative MSP, was reported for a non-crime hate incident for complaining, saying that being non-binary was like identifying as a cat. And he only found out about it because it got reported to the authorities in the Scottish Parliament, who then told him. But that ping had been on his record, and without him having a chance to contest it or argue the point.
Right, and what?
And is there no charge of being just lame? Which, again, I would probably
not yet. Argue for prosecution with crap jokes now. I don't know that that's going to help us out very much.
This is great. I love this.
No, it was more
platform.
A definition. I wasn't suggesting it was illegal.
So we should have a. Adam thinks the internet should be switched off for a couple of hours to give everyone a chance to calm down.
The solution to absolutely everything is we just switch the internet off for several hours every day and we all have to go out in the fresh air. I think that would sort most of the problems in the world out.
Right. Good. That's our policy platform for
it's
next
good.
Section.
It's good.
But I mean, I think I can predict certainly some of what is going to happen next, which is going to be that there will be a load of free speech martyrs who are absolutely determined to be charged on this. There'll be a load of people on the other side who are absolutely determined to continually report them to the police and demand that they do get charged. There'll be an awful lot of police time wasted on something we'll finally never end up in anything. And, in the end of it, all sorts of other stuff that the police should be investigating, not getting investigated in Scotland, be that very expensive camper vans or rapes and murders.
Do you think J.K. Rowling enjoys the support of the publications that previously labelled her as boring old lefty who goes on about wealth inequality and writes these terrible novels that are a little bit on the side of redistribution of wealth? Do you think it's just par for the course, my enemy's enemy.
It is very funny that she has become a total hero to the Telegraph, despite all of her career up until that point, basically standing against everything that they supported. I think you're right, there is, I think, Adam, you bring up something which I think I do worry about in the backlash to this, which is people now feeling that need to say deliberately offensive things just to prove that you can. And I can understand the impulse behind it, but actually I think, you know, saying that you should be respectful and courteous to people is better done as a, here's the politeness of society, rather than as a legally enforced demand. That is obviously going to make people want to kick against it. And that's, again, that's not what we want
and
to happen.
Sort of deliberate misgendering just seems... Putting aside the cases of convicted sex offenders who've obviously been trying to pull a fast one and get into women's prisons, I'm not denying that they were there, but it's a tiny and unrepresented... You know, it's like taking the men who were arrested in Operation Spanner over sadomasochistic sex in the 80s as representative of all gay men, or it's like taking Wayne Cousins as representative of all straight men.
It is a different tone, and you were wondering whether the JK was meant to be a shield. But if so, it's... It was as badly drafted a tweet as the actual law is, because sticking in two people on the end of whatever you think about Monroe or sticking in your Willoughby is not the same as the rapists. And putting them all in a thing, it's not very clever, is it?
I probably have more sympathy, J.K. Rowling, for probably having faced some of the same people telling me I'm a bigot too. But I agree with you about the fact that it's maybe not helpful to lump in disparate concerns in that way. And I like the one thing I would always say about J.K. Rowling is she absolutely loves a ruck. And I think that she's decided this is an issue in which she is going to make some noise, and therefore that comes with a lot of people disagreeing with you in terms that range from the abusive to the polite. But that is a kind of function of being a kind of campaigner in the way that she's done it. I mean, I think for me, fundamentally, I come down to the fact that I basically agree with her. And so I'm happy to say that, even while saying I probably wouldn't have phrased it in those terms.
On which bit?
So Humza Yousaf, for example, during the drafting of this, wouldn't answer whether or not it was hateful to say there are only two sexes. And that's the kind of thing perhaps we should have clarified somewhere along the way.
That would help the police, certainly, wouldn't
it? Yeah, and the victims minister couldn't say whether or not misgendering was prima facie a hate crime. Again, that's the kind of thing you just need some clarity about. How much wiggle room is there? I think there's a huge difference between following someone down the street screaming abuse at them and saying something as a generalised statement about an ideology. And I don't think that the legislation clarifies really the difference between those two things.
Well, that's exactly a sensibly argued tone, as opposed to saying, look at all these people, some of them are murderers, some of them aren't, and some of them are presenters. I'm not sure that's hugely helpful.
I don't want to alarm you all, but I found a segue to what we're going to talk about next. Speaking of the internet being turned off and things being taken offline, something else has been taken offline. It's a long run-up I've taken.
Very good,
but
very good. I'm ready, I'm braced.
You can see where I've gone. Yep. This is the second thing we wanted to talk about today, which is Talk TV.
That's almost a brilliant segue, except that it's not. It's been taken off air and put online.
That's the problem. It's going offline, which confusingly means it's going online only. But it's been taken off.
And it hasn't yet either. No, it's going to happen in a couple of months. But other than that, it was definitely worthy of the one show. It was good.
I don't like these mid-show segue critiques at all. So Talk TV is going online only. It's being taken off air. So Piers Morgan's show, I think, has already done that.
Yep, he was the early adopter. He migrated already.
Yes, and this was announced quite recently, and you know, we've covered GB News a fair bit on this podcast before, but Talk TV a bit less so. And I just wanted to kick us off with a quote from Scott Taunton, and we've just been talking about Scott Taunton in a way, Scottish taunting, Scott Taunton. Never mind.
They get worse.
Yeah, aren't we glad I didn't go with that one? He's the president of broadcasting, and he told staff in a briefing, "I just wanted to see what you thought of this as a reason for moving Talk TV online only. 2 years ago," he said, "we would not have been brave enough to launch a channel without a linear presence, but audiences of all ages have moved fast, and smartphones are now the primary device. As far as news is concerned, we are therefore intending that Talk TV comes off linear television from early summer." Do you buy that?
Hang on a minute. So 2 years ago in 2022, no one had heard of the smartphone. No one was using them. Very niche technology.
What Scott Taunton is actually doing there is, to use a technical broadcasting term, talking complete bollocks. Because actually, News UK, who run Talk TV, Rupert Murdoch's company, put an awful lot of money and an awful lot of time into seeing whether there was any appetite for a linear TV channel. And they concluded many years ago that there wasn't, and they would be much better off doing some kind of programming on demand. There was talk about, and actually this is a way that technology has moved on, but about Fire Sticks and people having little things they would be able to plug into a port on the side of their telly and be able to watch Murdoch TV on that. And there were all sorts of things that were explored, but it was very definitively concluded, and the news was expressed to all staff by Rebecca Brooks, the CEO of News UK, that there was not a viable financial future for any sort of linear TV channel. At which point, she was overruled by Rupert, who said he liked TV channels and he wanted one anyway. So they did it, and it crashed and burned exactly as they had predicted it would. And now they are going back to, it's sort of plan A. It's plan A and a half, I suppose, where they're going to have this weird sort of... It was always a bizarre hybrid anyway, because basically it's a radio station. For most of the hours of the day, it's just talk radio with a camera pointed at it. Mm. And talk radio is a pretty successful radio station. But then they decided to do this primetime thing where they would have Piers Morgan and they would have Tom Newton Dunn, no longer there. They would have Sharon Osbourne, who barely ever turned up for her show anyway. And it would be this sort of all singing, all dancing TV station. But no one watched that at all.
Yeah. It's the old motto, isn't it? Go non-woke, go broke. There's two channels now we've had. I just can't wait for the rest of them.
But it also suggests, well, what does success look like in that space, right? So I think GB News, correct me if I'm wrong, hasn't done amazingly well financially, but as a means of influencing the direction of the Conservative Party, it seems to be incredibly good, right?
So GB News, saying we should be grateful because it's taken them to its lowest poll rate ever and they're about to disappear.
Right, as it nosedives the Tory party into the ground, the only people crawling out of the rubble will be presenters on GB News. But you know what I mean? I think it's very popular with the selectorate who pick the next Tory leader. If you think these are a group of people who voted for Liz Truss freely out of their own, you know, without any coercion at all.
GB News gets talked about is completely disproportionate to the number of people who are watching it. And it's not just on the right, it's not just the Tories electorate, because it winds up lefties as well. I mean, it has this extraordinary profile, and they're pretty good on the stuff they put out on social media, and they get so if you're not looking to make a profit, and it's very, very far from making a profit, it's hemorrhaging money, GB News, but that isn't what it's there for. It's there so that Paul Marshall and the other investors can have their say in the political sphere and in the culture wars, and it's been extremely effective as that. Talk TV never quite managed that. I mean, it was actually much more professionally run. In terms of Ofcom complaints, I'm not sure that there have actually been any. I mean, GB News has had multiple ones. So if they
no
have,
one watched
fairly,
it.
No problem. Well, it probably is. I mean, they could be doing absolutely anything and no one would know it. We did say before we came into this podcast, Ellen said to me, I don't really know much about Talk TV, to be honest. I said, it's fine. We can say whatever we want. No one does. No one's ever seen it. Bigfoot or the Yeti. It's rumoured to be out there somewhere. People have heard things and seen footprints, but no one actually knows whether it is or not.
But that's a weird thing about Talk TV and GB News and how GB News has been so influential. It is in a TV space that is quite similar to the Mail. Because one of the elements of this discussion is how much or how quickly or which papers are going to switch to supporting Labour before the next election, and whether they're doing so because they can see the writing on the wall and they're trying to get out ahead of public opinion. You know, they're not actually leading it. And most papers have much smaller readerships than they did 30 years ago. So they are much less influential than they were. Even back then, they were probably following public opinion as much as leading it. Mm. But one point made recently, I think there was a piece in The Guardian about this, is that, you know, the BBC is still obsessed with reading the papers and takes a lot of its lines and discussion points from there. And GB News has done exactly that for Paul Marshall, whereas Talk TV hasn't really.
Right, you know. There's a commercial version of you just want to run a TV station with a load of adverts on it that makes you a load of money. And that in the cable news era was a really good thing to do. You just had a mass viewership thing. Now, as you say, with GB News, it's much more like the traditional reason for owning a newspaper. You wanted to be a kind of player. But yeah, I mean, I have to say, the only things I ever consumed of Talk TV were clips of Piers Morgan shouting at sort of 20-year-olds who'd ill-advisedly wandered onto his show.
Those are still going, that has to be said, even though he is no longer going out on the channel every night at 8 o'clock. I mean, it's very odd hybrid now, because as I say, it hasn't shut down the linear TV channel, but I had a look at their website just before we came in, and it's flogging a lot of catch up and listen again, but most of it for talk radio shows. A lot of it for Piers Morgan, who doesn't go out on the channel at all, but is just branded as himself as Piers Morgan Uncensored now on YouTube. And also this new thing, which we've written about in the last couple of hours, called Sun TV, which appears to be possibly the replacement for Talk TV. No one's quite sure. At the moment, it consists of one show, one weekly show called Never Mind the Ballot. Do you see what they've done there? With Harry Cole, the Sun's political editor, and Kate McCann, who is the now the political editor of Times Radio, having been the political editor of Talk TV. So they're shuffling people around between all of these different outlets, and they don't seem to be sure which how to distinguish between them themselves. So that's all part of the Talk TV offering now. So I would say there does seem to be an awful lot of confusion at News UK at the moment about exactly what's going on with it and what they're going to do with it. Less confusion about who's being blamed for it, because, of course, when it comes to the actual job losses, which are going to result from the shutdown of Talk TV, do you think it's any of the senior executives who are responsible for this debacle going? Go on, have a wild guess.
No. And I mean, the pieces in the Eye have repeatedly suggested that it's all Rupert's fault, because he was told not to do this and he did it anyway. Yeah. So the chances of him taking the blame are fairly slight.
This is Rupert, who you will recall retired from the day-to-day running of News UK about 6 months ago, didn't he? But I think he's still having quite a big say in what goes on there.
Well, explain this then, which Helen brought up, is when it comes to the Sun newspaper, Rupert is, I say Rupert because we're obviously incredibly friendly, he is always willing to say it's the Sun what won it, usually if he's changed sides the day before the election or even after, if necessary. So he will always shift. His television output is always right wing. Why is that? It's Rupert. I told you, not in the office. For sake, it's so embarrassing. If they knew that I was in daily contact.
You say that it's always right wing, but I consumed a bit of Never Mind the Ballots, which I have to say, if they bring in your anti-lameness law, is going to be in serious danger of prosecution, along with the Sky's electile dysfunction. And I thought, Andy, I hope you feel better about some of your puns now. It's wild out there. But the Sun TV did an interview with Keir Starmer that was, I thought, very notable in the fact that it took him very seriously. The subsequent coverage and the thing said, he's got a, actually, this Keir Starmer guy, he's not the kind of terrible communist you might have thought.
Front page splash, which is in a way more of an endorsement. Your first episode of this new politics show and front page splash, which I would say, in terms of actually getting in front of viewers and readers' eyes, is a lot more important than anything in the editorial column.
That's really interesting.
And wasn't it Harry Cole conducting the interview with him?
It was
the
indeed.
Sun's political.
Yeah.
So he was last seen. I mean, his last encounter with Starmer was putting him in a front page story saying Starmer travelled around the world freeing monsters and rapists and killers and pedos, and when they were all on death row. And what an awful thing that was to do.
At the moment, they are very much trying to have it both ways, the Sun. So we have a very, very approving interview with Rachel Reeves, and I think they mocked her up in a Thatcher wig to say she is the new Thatcher a couple of weeks ago.
And then you get Trevor
Kavanagh saying, no, they're all useless, they're all terrible, they're all lefty. So at the moment, they're kind of looking which way to go. I mean, they will. The Sun always... It's never the Sun what won it, but it's always the winners what won the Sun. I mean, Rupert always backs a winner, and Sun editors as well, who are allowed a bit of a say of their own, I believe, always want to back a winner as well. But the idea that it's some long-term endorsement...
I have to do whatever Rupert says.
I mean, there's this great myth that's kind of grown up around 1997 and the idea that the Sun swung behind... Well, they did do that, but do you know when they did it?
Was it the 4th of May, 1997?
Not quite that, but the polling day was May the 1st. It was March the 18th, so it's really late on in things. And everyone says, and it's because, of course, he went over to Hayman Island and he went to the Murdoch conference and he sucked up to money. It was 2 years after that. I mean, there was 2 years, a lot more work going into it as well, which I'm sure is going on in the Labour Party at the moment, because they will be working as hard to, very, very hard to get the endorsement of both the Sun and the Times, because there is still this tradition that newspaper endorsements matter in some way. I'm not sure that's ever actually been true. I mean, the Mail at the moment seems to be sort of equidistantly hostile to the Tories and Labour, so there's going to be some interesting triangulation that goes on when this election does get called.
It strikes me that Tory supporting newspapers support not the Tory party as it currently is in government, but a Tory party in their own heads, consisting of Suella Braverman and Nigel Farage, who isn't even in the party, and a few others. So they're not traditionally Tory supporting, and I'm interested that once we get past the election, will papers like The Telegraph, The Express, The Mail, will they know anyone left in mainstream politics? Or will they focus entirely on the fringe?
Are we going to have our first reform-supporting paper?
That would be interesting.
I mean,
that is the direction that The Telegraph is going in entirely. I mean, if you look at all of their coverage, they are way to the right of where the Tory party are on them. They've just signed up Suella Braverman as a columnist, so that gives you an idea of where they're at in the Tory party, as she barely is these days. But it's possible, you know, stranger things have happened.
But there's also a problem between the kind of Liz Truss libertarianism and the kind of what the UKIP offer was, which was, yes, very right-wing on things like immigration, you might say, but also very strongly in favour of a social security welfare. Now, as you say, Adam, the triple lock on pensions, I think it would be suicidal for anyone to repeal against that. So there is a kind of space for a party that is socially conservative, but actually fiscally is more in the place where Labour is. And I think that's where Reform is probably trending.
Well, don't Reform support nationalisation of various key industries?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you know who you're voting for, Adam.
But they're polling pretty well, as far as we can see.
I think Reform are ahead among men. All men.
And now only men can vote, thank God.
Not all men, Anne.
Yeah. Let's come back to it.
The Express, by the way, on Tuesday morning this week was calling for a referendum on immigration. Just sort of a yes. Do you like it?
Wait,
do you want it?
We no, have one. Yes have or one no? Those. Right. We have one in 2016.
Yep. Shh. We were pretending that was about something else.
Ian, who's the I going to endorse?
I'll just check Rupert. It's still unsure. Sorry.
Talking of things that men like.
Let's go finally to the Garrick. Well, three of us can go to the Garrick. Actually, Matt, Matt, the producer, you're also welcome to come to the Garrick.
Guys, it's very supportive.
Can I not come? Is that all right?
Right. This is the Garrick Club, founded in 1831, named after the great actor David Garrick, who was no longer alive at that time. But the club's stated purpose was to be somewhere that actors and men of refinement could meet on equal terms and I'm quoting here, tend to the regeneration of the drama. And that is something that Garrick has been doing in the last few weeks, because there have been all sorts of, there have been resignations, there has been brouhaha over the fact that it's a men-only club, you know, very high-profile membership, Cumberbatch, Bonneville, Suchet, Gove, you name it.
All the great actors of every age.
The great shapeshifters of our time. And there has been this long-running campaign to change the rules and allow women in, which has not so far proved successful, despite, you know, loads of the members clearly really being absolutely desperate to make this change. For some reason, it just hasn't happened.
The sad thing is, last time they had a referendum, there was a majority in favour of changing the rules to admit women. But it's just you have to have a two-thirds majority.
It was pretty nice. It was 50.5%.
Yes. Yeah. Come all Brexity, Andy. Yeah. If you don't like a two-thirds majority, you would have liked one over Brexit, I bet.
There was an overwhelming mandate from the Garrick members to keep it men only. And this has blown up recently, partly because The Guardian have printed a large number of the members' names, which have included all these pillars of civil society as well.
Yeah, and it was a huge scoop. It was written by Amelia Gentleman, which, given that it was about gentlemen's clubs, was incredibly funny. And the list itself was revealing. I mean, partly because of the names that didn't appear in it. But I gather they had to go through some procedure. Is that right, Helen?
What I understand is that because of privacy concerns, you can't just blast out the entire email list. So there has to be a public interest justification for making someone's private club affiliation public. So that's why I think the list is very much focused on senior civil servants, judges, you know, people who have a role in shaping laws or shaping policy, and therefore their membership of an exclusive club is therefore a matter of public interest.
So it was decided at a high level at The Guardian that there was no public interest in naming, for instance, Amelia Gentleman's father-in-law, Stanley Johnson.
Yes.
Who's very, very keen on women from a lot of things we've heard about.
I really respect Amelia for this, because she must have known the massive amount of piss-taking that was going to flow. She went and did the story anyway, and I sort of respect that.
Hey, we had to phone up Simon Jenkins last week and say, they're not naming you either, are they? And he, it turns out, very supportive of women members as well. So many of them working so hard.
Yes, he wrote a column on that. Anyway. Can you give me the gossip, Adam? Who am I in Flute Street is a member?
They're in the Guardian's coverage of it, but not in the Mail's coverage of it. Paul Dacre, editor-in-chief of Associated Newspapers. Very much in the Mail's coverage of it, but not in the Guardian's, former member Alan Rusbridger, ex-editor-in-chief of the Guardian, who resigned in 2010 shortly after...
He tried to get Lord Miners appointed.
Lord Miners, who had been boss of the Guardian Media Group and then went on to be city minister. And there was a lot of questions over tax and things, weren't there?
Oh,
there was
really?
Some dodginess, He was blackballed and Alan Rusbridger resigned that year, which he's probably quite grateful about now, because that would have been a bit embarrassing, wouldn't it?
It would. I mean, I think the Garrick we should say that it's always been a source of enormous amusement. Francis Wheen, former Eye journalist, found some coverage of the Garrick in Reynolds' newspaper from the 1st of August 1858. And this is what Francis Wheen reads over his breakfast. But it does say the Garrick Club is one of those snob snuggeries that abound in London. It consists for the greater part of comic authors, Whig journalists, 10th-rate artists. And it goes on, fast barristers, faded dandies, Irish and Ethiopian melodists, unspeakable MPs, roué noblemen, impudent showmen. It just goes on and on with this extraordinary list. And it says the point of the Garrick Club has as its object the cultivation of priggism and is a place for inveterate tuft hunters.
Mm.
What's a tuft hunter?
A tuft hunter is someone who's a snob. It's a sort of a social climber or a snob. And I know that through personal experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I was actually tuft hunter of the year when I left school. As a comic author and I would say 10th rate artist, I quite like the sound of the Garrick. I used to walk past it all the time.
Where is it?
It's in Covent Garden.
I'm not even allowed to look at it as a woman. I have to wear my
are allowed in on ladies' night.
Ladies' night.
I don't know if I've got the...
behind the bar. There's a male stripper, which unfortunately is an actor over 70.
But it's not... I was quite surprised to find it's not the only all-male club in London, is it? There are still several more that don't admit women.
Yeah, Whites, I know, is one of them. Because I think the male used to have its Christmas backbench dinner there, and I always thought, what if a woman needs to be invited? But luckily it never came up.
I have been to several clubs that full of men, and they're all generally dancing with their tops off. So, I mean, this is the image I have of Paul Dacre and Simon Heffer and Simon Jenkins there, and it's off with the salmon and cucumber ties and up on the podium. So, is that what goes on?
I think it's a different sort of men's club, Adam.
No, the names are extraordinary. So the other all-male clubs, as far as I can tell, are the Beefsteak, the Travellers, Brooks, Boodles and Whites, which did allow the Queen in, but I think under sufferance. As long as she promised not to act up.
There is, I should say, one women's only club, which is the University Women's Club, which is over in Mayfair. So there is a total terrible discrimination against men is perpetuated in that one.
But do you have to be at a university to go to that one?
Yes.
Or a specific university?
I think it's just generally.
Right.
Because all of these clubs do have quite a strong financial discrimination in their structure, which is...
You've got to be rich.
It's really
and
expensive.
And the Garrick, as Pravdi pointed out early in the 80s, it's bores only. and generations of non-boring people have tried to get in as members, but every time they're outvoted and the bores win again. We have found the Garrick Club immensely funny for the entire longevity of the magazine. And we ran a fantastically successful ad for a new Barbie doll, which is the Garrick Club Barbie, which has a wine-stained tie and a blazer and soup-stained trousers. The point about this doll was you pull the cord and she reminisces about meeting Kingsley Amis and the Master of the Rolls and how Sir John Gielgud had spotted dick and custard. It is one of the mysteries as to why women would actually want to belong to this club.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the judges came in, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you were, for example, Lady Hale, who was the Supreme Court Justice, I think she once spoke about it. She said basically all of my colleagues are all going and hanging out together all the time. And there is a whole thing, one mustn't discuss work at the Garrick. But it is a bit like the way that there was a big feminist backlash against, you know, people going to strip clubs after work and that bit, or golf clubs, you know, and those being the kind of way where the lads all did their deals together. That is very exclusionary, and if you're the only woman in a male-dominated field. I don't know. I've got friends who aggressively don't care about this issue at all.
That's fair enough. But I think in the Garrick, it was meant to be an actors' club, and the reason everyone writes about it, rather than Whites or Boodles, is because it's not full of boring old judges. It's full of supposedly glamorous actors, and that's meant to be the draw. And the funny thing is, if you go in and you look at the wall, it's entirely pictures of actresses who obviously aren't allowed to be members. So fabulous pictures of, you know, all the greats, and then but they can't come in.
How weird. Have you been in it?
I'm always in there, and I go in with Rupert Murdoch. And we talk about who we're going to marry next. you just couldn't do that if there were women around.
Just one piece of coverage of this. There was in one of a gentleman's pieces in The Guardian, she was speaking to one member of the clergy who was a member and said to her, "The resistance is crumbling. It feels like 1989 when chunks started to be knocked out of the Berlin Wall."
Except it's a wall of like pastry and beef Wellington. Oh, it's very moving.
I know,
it
is.
Sort of implying that women have been deprived of their basic human rights and listened into by the Stasi on the other side of the Carrick walls.
What about my human right to drink a great claret at lunchtime? Come
but
on.
There is a good bit of news is that they've been looking at the legislation and the club rules. It's not actually legally, but the club association rules. And they've brought in Lord Panic. If you remember, he very successfully defended Boris Johnson during Partygate. Yeah. So good luck, Ned. And he's noticed that in the original wording, it's the word he is continually used for a member. But this doesn't mean that he is a man.
He can apparently now, Lord Panic has agreed with Michael Beloff QC, that he can apply equally to men and women. Which is sort of bringing us around full circle in terms of segues right to where we began this conversation.
I mean, that is a hoist on their own petard there, because I remember doing feminist language theory all the way through. You know, it was always kind of like, actually, if we just say, you know, man the hunter, that's fine, because that actually means humans. So I think, in a way, it's kind of all the brutal things to be brought down, and saying that he applies equally to everybody was a very fashionable position if you were a reactionary in the 1980s. So if that's now going to screw them over and let women in, it's sort of poetic justice, I think.
I'm just thinking about J.K. Rowling applying to become a member. Is this going to make people's heads explode? I think it is.
She can just bore on about her favourite pet subjects, can't she? She'd be very welcome.
And that's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again in a fortnight with another one. And if you would like to drop us a line about any of these things, you can get to us on podcast@private-i.co.uk. We welcome your questions, comments. Do write in podcast@private-i.co.uk. We love hearing from you. This episode, as so many of them are, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.